So I'll be talking today about models of agency in early China. But in deference to those of you who are not in Chinese studies, I'd like to begin with a brief introduction to the historical and textual context of what we call early China, of the early Chinese period. So early China begins roughly with the first evidence of writing in the 13th century BC in a place called Anyang, which was the last capital of the Shang Kingdom. And this writing is in the form of oracle bone inscriptions, such as the turtle plastron that you can see in the image. And these animal bones were used for plastromancy, which is a plea for the gods to mediate in favor of human will. But the longer texts that we study have an origin in the Warring States period, so from the 5th to the 3rd centuries BC. And this is a time of civil war in which 8 different states were fighting each other constantly for hegemony, right, to control the territory. And so the Warring States period ended when the state of Qin won the war and it established the first unified empire, the Qin dynasty, which gives way to our word for China. And, but the Qin dynasty wasn't long-lived. It was quickly overthrown by the much longer and influential Han dynasty, which goes on until the 3rd century of our era. And now I'd like to show you how the texts from this period looked like. Written on bamboo or silk, they were short compositions in the form of essays, narratives, dialogues, aphorisms, odes, lists, poems, and so on. And they were composed out of basic units, which have been called building blocks by Bill Bolt. So these building blocks, they were movable, and they could be combined in different ways, making up for different texts. And then in the Han Dynasty, responding to the needs of the newly established imperial library, scholars felt the need, the pressure to order, classify, and catalog the intellectual heritage from the past. So in a long and complex process that involved edition, additions, deletions, interpolations, commentary, interpretation, and even translation, our books from early China were born. So now, why am I telling you all this? I'm telling you this because when we think about, for example, the philosophy, the Warring States philosophy of the Zhuangzi, right? We think about the Zhuangzi having an internal coherence and consistency that is intended by the single book with a single author, right? But this is quite misleading because the Zhuangzi, much as most of the other books from the early Chinese period, are actually a Han dynasty compilation of heterogeneous materials, which were written by different Hans at different time periods. So this means that our early texts, our early books, are composite. And the fact that they are composite texts has, of course, bearing on the way in which we should deal with these texts, and in particular, the ways in which we should do early Chinese philosophy, which is my field. So I'll be happy to talk about my methodological approach later on during the Q&A or maybe at any other time since I'm always there in my office. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my research in broad terms. So my research focuses on patterns of argument in early China in relation to the problem of human agency. And these patterns are viewed as more or less successful responses to problems of uncertainty, morality, efficacy, control, and freedom. So in other words, I deal with the problems of coping with the future, decision-making, and how to act from the perspective of early Chinese philosophies. And then I focus on what I call the model of adaptive agency as a privileged solution to these problems. So what's adaptive agency? I think it's likely the first thing that the word adaptation draws to your mind is Darwin and his theory of evolution. As you all know, Darwin postulated evolution as a process through which organisms' physical and behavioral traits change over time, becoming better fitted or adjusted to their habitat. So that's a process known as adaptation. But in the 20th century, the concept of adaptation has been traveling back and forth between the natural and the social sciences. And it's actually been applied to a multitude of fields, from cultural ecology and climate change, to business, military theory, and even informatics and programming. Yet there is a fundamental difference between the concept of adaptation, the biological concept of adaptation, and then the concept of adaptation in fields beyond the natural sciences, the biological sciences. In biology, the way that Darwin postulated it, the concept of adaptation involves a dynamic process. It's dynamic, but it is blind. It was Richard Hawkins who qualified adaptation as a blind process in the 80s. He has this book, The Blind Watchmaker, because he wanted to emphasize that there is not an agency, an intentionality, a God planning for these adaptive changes to happen, right? But in the social sciences, adaptation, the normative concept, involves human agency and purposiveness. So in the social sciences, adaptation has become a planned, thoughtful, intentional strategy that involves anticipation of tendencies of development and adjusted responses to effective management. My usage of the term adaptation involves, of course, the normative concept. And I would like to give you a brief working definition of adaptation. It is a process through which the agent purposively adjusts to the context in order to deal with an uprising situation in the most efficacious way possible. Now, this is my definition of adaptation applied to early China, early Chinese philosophy. It's my definition, but it's strongly based on my research in the primary sources. Now, the fact that the agent adjusts to the context means that he or she or it takes the situation that he's involved in as his parameters to decide on the best course of action. So everything is going to be an adjusted response to some context in which you are involved. And this model for choosing an action as an adjusted, fitted, or adapted response to a specific situation contrasts with other models of action that we also find in the early Chinese literature, such as prescriptive agency, which is conforming. We are going to talk later about conforming to pre-established, non-negotiable guidelines for action. And it also contrasts with other model, the model of forceful agency, which is based on the agent's random arbitrary preferences and desires, imposing them no matter the context. Then my definition also includes the reason why an agent may want to behave adaptively, which is achieving efficacy. Efficacy is performing a function in the best way possible, and it often implies a sense of making a good use, a satisfactory use of resources and competencies. But efficacy is an empty concept. It depends on what we want to achieve, what is intended to be achieved. So it's going to be defined differently depending on the agent's goals. Now, in early Chinese philosophy, we find adaptive agency associated with different kinds of goals. We have instrumental goals, such as winning a battle, defeating an enemy. That's something that we often find in the military literature. There are also goals that we can call moral, living a better life. That's often the case in the Zhuangzi. Or ethical goals, achieving a better relationship with the environment and with other people. That's very prominent in the Huainanzi. There are even soteriological goals, like achieving mental peace, freedom, and liberation. But all in all, the early Chinese texts that advocate for adaptive agency, they claim that adaptation produces the best possible response. Oh, I'm sorry about that. It doesn't matter. So it's the best possible response for an agent of certain features in a given situation, given certain intended goals. So overall, the adaptive person is a situational, contextual, reflective, and flexible agent capable of designing strategies ad hoc. That means transient courses of action for specific, non-permanent, and non-generalizable life problems. Now for today, I've chosen my topic, adapting to the interests of most fellows here at IKGF. So I'll be talking about adaptive agency in the context of early Chinese divination practices. And this will give me a chance to show how what I'm calling adaptation is different from what I'm gonna call the mantic model of action, which is a conformity model. And now it's time to talk about what's the conformity model, what's conforming. Now, conforming is short for conforming to calendrical rules that reflect the order of nature. So it's conforming to a macro order, or what we can call macro changes. That's to say changes that are cyclical and therefore can be anticipated, or how I like to call them, changes that do not change. In China, much as in many other ancient civilizations, the sky was scrutinized in search of patterns and regularities that could be applied to the ordering of society. Lisa Raffles, whom many of you know here, has a very nice analogy to explain how divination and emerology, which is the mantic use of the calendar, provided the person with a useful set of guidelines for action. So she says that a railway timetable doesn't cause the train to arrive, but it helps the person to be on the platform on time, right? As opposed to being there waiting for 2 hours. So emerology divination is gonna provide the means to deal with risk and uncertainty and also provide efficacy in action. But in early China, conforming to these cosmic rules was not only a question of efficacy in action. At the public level, it became a question of state ideology that contributed to debates about who's going to be a deserving, legitimate ruler. The ideology was reversed to imply that not following the calendrical rules that reflected the order of nature would bring disorder into nature itself. And of course, great chaos and disaster for human society. So this suggests that the calendar was much more than just a useful tool. It was a prescriptive method that set the lines of adequate behavior. This is all very clear in a textual type that we know as the monthly ordinances, the Yuelin. The locus classicus of the Yuelin is the Li Ji Yuelin. But we can find it also in many other texts, such as Lu Shechun, Qiu Huainanzi, and some manuscripts. So monthly ordinances as a text type is like an almanac-like text that sets up the months and the seasons, and it correlates descriptive phenomena in the natural realm with prescriptive activities in the human realm, especially for the ruler to conform to these natural patterns, right? And Ethan Harkness, whom I'm sure many of you also know, I think he's been here, he suggested that the last 21 sleeps of the Kongjiapuo Reshu, this day book that you can see in the image, contain something similar to the monthly ordinances. So I'm gonna show you an extract from that text. I could show you the Li Ji Yuelin, but this is more fun because it's not so well known. So I'll read it for you. If the formations and dispersions of each season do not match up appropriately, so that means if the beginnings and ends of the season don't match up with the appropriate ritual activities of the ruler, then everything goes wrong. The grasses and trees will not produce seed, armed conflict will arise, and so on and so on. So everything goes all right. But if they do match up, then everything is fine. So the ruler has this role in preserving the order of nature. So this is a typical case of conformity, of conforming. Now, as you know, in early China, there were many other kinds of divination apart from numerology. There is plastromancy and stock casting divination linked to the I Ching. And there is evidence also of dream divination, physiognomy, analysis of bird calls and astrolabes and so on. There are many different kinds. And of course, the particularities of the use of all these kinds varies. But they are all means to deal with uncertainty, deal with risk, achieve efficacy in action, and they all entail some sort of conforming to certain patterns that are extracted from the natural realm. So that's conformity. Now I have explained adaptation and conformity. Now I'd like to contrast the two models. Conforming and adapting are both very visible and prominent models of action in the early Chinese literature. And, but the conformity model has been much better acknowledged in modern scholarship. Think, for example, of Pan Kinir's book, Conforming Earth to Heaven, right? I think it's his last book. And actually, the adaptive model hasn't been studied at all. It's usually subsumed under the conformity model. So that's what I've been doing in my dissertation, analyzing the adaptive model in detail. And the confusion between conformity and adaptation is based in that there are actually many similarities between the two models. So I'm gonna give you just a few of the most important ones. The first similarity, it's kind of technical. The main word to convey the meaning of adaptation in early China was yin. And this word can also has a technical meaning of conforming only in calendrical texts, which is funny. And it's actually quite complicated. I've brought this table with me. All those graphs in Chinese are words that can be used to convey the meaning of adaptation. But as you can see, they also have other meanings. So we have to resort to some philological and semantical analysis to discern when each one of these words in their context mean one thing or the other, right? But I won't talk about that now. If you're interested in the philological aspects, then we can talk about it later. So that's the first similarity. Then the second one is very obvious. Both adapting and conforming are models of action, strategies to cope with the future, and so on. And the third one is quite interesting, is that both modes of action involve a sense of self-abandonment. So they are self-decentered models of action. Insofar, they involve taking something external to the self as a standard for deciding one's actions. So think, for example, of the ruler that we were talking about earlier, the ruler of the monthly ordinances. He's taking these ordinances as, and not himself, as the norm for his own behavior, for his conventionalized behavior. And the same happens with an adaptive agent. The adaptive person is gonna take the situation, the context in which he's involved, as his parameters to decide on the best course of action. So he cannot go with his whim, with his own desires and preferences. All right, so those are the three main similarities. And although they share these similarities, I think the two models are still very different. And I have attempted here an outline of the features that separate what I'm calling the mantic conforming from the philosophical adapting. Okay, the first one is that conforming doesn't require creative responses. Users resort to mantic knowledge precisely in search of conventionalized, ready-made answers to predictable situations, answers that are open for everyone to consult. And on the contrary, proposals advocating adaptation always emphasize the uniqueness and the creativity of the response to satisfy the specificity of the moment. So we have conventional versus creative responses. Then the second, conforming semantic methods allow the user to quickly and mechanically determine the proper course of action. And this offered a sense of mediated security, so mediated by semantic technology, right? Conforming, therefore, is a relatively unreflective, and I would push it and say a thoughtless mode of dealing with daily life. And on the contrary, adaptive responses required a thoughtful, reflective agent, an analytical mind able to read a situation and come up with a response. And of course, he didn't have any security net other than himself. He's not relying on any external technology. Then third, in relation to the other two, conforming to natural patterns, the agent didn't need to make any critical decisions by himself. The burden of responsibility is delegated onto the interpreter of the semantic method or onto the semantic method itself. Think that the calendar, the ratio, for example, doesn't need an interpreter to just look at it. And the adaptive agent, on the contrary, bore full responsibility for the correctness of his analysis of a situation and for everything that came out of that. So it's a responsible versus irresponsible, delegating responsibility kind of agent. And then the last difference between conforming and adapting regards a more general difference between the semantic and the philosophical approaches to uncertainty. While the semantic approach focuses on predicting what is to come, philosophical approaches, just like the adaptive approach, help the person accept not knowing what is to come, and yet making him or her prepared for coming up with the best possible response once that the situation arises. A good illustration of this is the case of illness. So the semantic approach to illness regards the diagnosis and the treatment, the therapeutic treatment. So the semantic approach to illness is a clinical approach. But the philosophical, in this case, the adaptive approach to illness emphasizes helping the person accept those changes that body and mind are undergoing and still for the person to be able to make the best use of them possible. So to use those changes as a grounds for constructing something else. All right. So we've come to the third part of the lecture here. And I have classified users of semantic methods as conforming agents. But now it is important that we differentiate between the users of the semantic methods and the mediators between the semantic methods and the consulters. So that's to say the diviners or the interpreters. So on the one hand, the results obtained through divination helped the consulter conform to certain patterns in order to deal with daily life and with the future. But interestingly, some early sources describe the interpreters, the diviners, as behaving in adaptive ways themselves. Now, in her discussion of marketplace diviners, Lisa Raffles explains that these diviners made use of people's common need for reassurance and guidance to improve their lives by rechanneling their ethical behavior. An illustration of this is the reflection about the diviner's profession by Yan Zhengping, who is a scholar and diviner from the first century and teacher of Yanxian. And this is his reflection about the profession of the diviner. He says, being a diviner is a low occupation, but can be used to benefit many people. If they have questions about what is wicked and not upright, I rely on turtle and milfoil to speak of the difference between benefit and harm. In treating with a son, I rely on divination to speak of filiality. In treating with a younger brother, I rely on divination to speak of obedience. In treating with a subject, I rely on divination to speak of loyalty. Each one of them, adapting to their situation, I lead toward doing good, and more than half of them conform to my words. So we see already here that the diviner adapts, whereas the consulters conform. And Junping uses what he calls a humble occupation, because he's a marketplace diviner and not a court diviner, to influence the way that people behave toward doing good, and therefore benefiting society overall. But to do so, the diviner needs to adapt to the precise situation of each consulter, because there is not a single mode of behaving in morally and ritually correct ways. And in a highly hierarchical society like early imperial China, where it's going to be sanctioned as good behavior, highly, strongly depends on social roles. So here, what the diviner adapts to, above all, is the consulter's social roles. Then, in a similar way, the Zhuozhuan accounts of stochastic divination show how open to interpretation each divination was. And it presents us with many case studies of the use of Yijing divination practice. And the Zhuozhuan, a brief introduction, I have here the book, if you wanna pass it around for those of you who don't know it. So the Zhuozhuan is a commentary to the Chunqiu, which is the spring and autumn. If everything is out of place in my, it doesn't matter. So it's the Chunqiu is the spring and autumn, the annals. It's a chronicle of the state of Lu for 255 years. The state of Lu is where Confucius was born in the 6th century BC. And the Chunqiu presents the most important events in the history of Lu, right, during this time period. The entries record events such as battles, marriages, and ritual offerings, sacrifices, or ominous events. But these entries are very short and kind of cryptic. They're pretty much incomprehensible without background information. And that information kind of is what the Zhuozhuan provides. Now, the Zhuozhuan quotes extensively from the Yijing, right, and from other classics. So we can take many instances of the usages of Yijing divination from there. And we see there that a good interpreter is the one able to match the messages from the Yi to the situation at hand. So it's the one able to adapt those messages to the context in which it's been asked. A bad interpreter is, in turn, the one who understands the E messages as closed, fixed truth statements, right? And takes these statements at face value. So I want to show you an example of this difference between the good and the bad interpreter. So this is a case from the Zhuozhuan. It's a minister who wants to revolt against his lord, and he casts talks, and he comes out with this result. This is the fifth line in Kun, which is the second hexagram in the received version of the Zhou Yi. So he's, he proceeds to interpret the result. And what he does, that's interpretation one. What he does is he takes a sentence as two homologous pairs. He says, we have yellow skirt, and we have primarily auspicious. Okay, so this is an auspicious result. I can go and revolt against my lord, and everything will be fine. But then a court diviner comes up and says, no, that's not the right interpretation. What he does is to understand the logic of the sentence as a conditional. So he says, only if we have yellow, skirt, and primal, then we have auspicious. Then it is an auspicious result. And then he follows a very complex hermeneutical process and associates each one of these words with one virtue. He says, yellow is loyalty, skirt is respect, and primal is goodness. Only if you have these three virtues, then it is an auspicious result. And obviously, the revolting minister lacks in all these three virtues. So he tells him, for you, in this case, it is not an auspicious result. Okay? So if you want to know, the minister doesn't conform to this result. He doesn't listen to the professional diviner. And he revolts against his lord, being immediately defeated and killed. Now, you can understand this story as a case of moralizing rhetoric, saying, well, ministers shouldn't revolt against their lords, right? But you can also see this anecdote as a case of what separates the good from the bad interpreter, and what's a successful interpretation. Okay, so this is all very straightforward. That's a case of what I call minimal adaptability. So it's a question of professional expertise, being able to adapt a message to a particular context, and it's what separates the good from the bad interpreter. But then what is more interesting is that the Zhuozhuan also gives us examples of what I'm going to call some more radical adaptability. This radical adaptability is not only matching a message with a situation or a question. It's about absolutely changing the interpretation of the results obtained in accordance with either the consulters of the diviner's needs and desires. So it's making whatever you want to make out of the results. And in that case, it's a question of using the I Ching or divination in general as expedient means. So these diviners that use this radical adaptability, they didn't necessarily believe in the prophetic value, the prophetic power of the I Ching. What they did believe in is the psychological power of the mantic technology in general, and put it to use to say whatever they want to say in a persuasive way. So I want to say here that these diviners used the hexagrams in the same way that the adaptive person used circumstances or the context. Both hexagrams and circumstances function as objective, somewhat determining reality that, rather than imposing a particular path or course of action, presents an opportunity to create the most useful response in any case. So the interpreter that we are going to see next is not really consulting the I in search of directions for the future or instructions for the future, but using the client's belief in the mantic system to say his message in a more persuasive way. So I'm going to give you one example of this radical adaptability. Here we have the Earl of Qin, and he's going to go into battle with the state of Jin. So he orders a divination, and the result is Gu. Oh, the hexagram doesn't come up. Okay. So he got Gu, and this is an objectively bad result. Okay, it's not auspicious at all. The range of meanings of Gu is from insanity, rotten, plague, parasites, spells, sorcery, and so on. So it's pretty much like rotten meat that attracts diseases and insects and so on. It's not good. But the diviner has to give an auspicious result to the Earl of Qin. Why is that? Because the Earl of Qin is not asking, should I go into battle? He's gonna go, he has to, it's settled, okay? What he's asking is, how is it gonna go for me? Am I gonna bring my soldiers back home, or are we gonna all die in battle, right? What he needs is a reassurance response. And that's what the diviner has to provide. So the diviner needs to give this auspicious answer, and he resorts to two hermeneutic tricks to do so. The first one, he very conveniently associates the first trigram, which is mountain, to Jin, the enemy. And then that's the upper trigram, and then the lower trigram, which is wind, he assigns to Qin, the consulter. And he says, metaphorically, the Qin wind destroys the crops of the Jin's mountains, okay? So we could have done exactly the opposite, right? We could have signed the trigrams in the opposite way. And I forgot to say, this story is fully translated in, what's his name? In Kidder Smith's Joey interpretation different accounts in the Zhuozhuan. And there, Kidder Smith says, well, we could even say here that the Jin Mountain remains unshaken despite the Qin winds, right? So my point here is that the interpretation is absolutely arbitrary. It's whatever he wants to say. Then the second hermeneutic trick is in how he reads these verses that accompany the hexagram at the time. They read, a thousand chariots, thrice dispelled, of God remains of three dispellings, capture the male fox. Okay, so in principle, we don't know to whom the victorious chariots belong, but of course the diviner is gonna say it's the Qin chariots, you're gonna win. So he gives this result, it's very auspicious, it's all great, you're gonna win the battle. And anyways, my point here is that the results are absolutely ambiguous, like mostly everything in the I Ching. And the interpretation is absolutely arbitrary. The only thing that makes the interpretation not be arbitrary is that it is tailored to the needs of the consulter, the Earl of Qin in this case. So the diviner adapts the mantic results not only to the particular circumstances, like in a minimal adaptability case, but also to his client's needs in order to create an encouraging message. And this encouraging message provides psychological support and legitimacy to the war that is about to come. Now, the question of whether the I Ching has semantic or prognosticating power is absolutely irrelevant in situations like this. What matters is its psychological legitimizing power, which can only be deployed fully by an adaptive interpreter. In these cases, the interpreters do not conform, but adapt, which makes them fully thoughtful, creative agents deciding their own or their consultor's destinies. Now, as I said before, so the hexagrams function as the circumstances for these adaptive diviners, right? They are a kind of objective reality that we can use in any way we want, and we can use as grounds to create a useful response, the most useful course of action. And here it's interesting to think about Kidder Smith's classification of the two different ways of using the I Ching in the Zhuozhuan. So he says the first way of using it is by quoting divination casting results, like the case we just saw, right? So it's really someone casting stacks and seeing a specific case of what happens next. And then the second is the rhetorical use of the E lines. So this is the case of someone making an argument and choosing some lines from the I Ching as proof text, as a book of wisdom to illustrate or support his own argument. So on the quoting divination casting, the results cannot be controlled, right? You just cast tags and you get what you get. So Kidder Smith says, in that case, the results determine the argument. You're gonna make an a results-led kind of argument, depending on what you get. And in the other, in the rhetorical use of the I Ching, it's the other way around. The speaker knows the argument that he wants to make beforehand, and then he chooses, purposively, the lines from the I Ching that suit his argument. So it's an argument-led choice of text. But what I'm trying to show here is that this distinction is not also clear-cut, because an adaptive interpreter, an adaptive diviner, can use whatever results he gets to make his pre-established argument. So it's gonna be a case of an argument-led choice of results. Not choice of results because he doesn't choose the results, but he can use whatever results he gets to make his case, okay? All right, so we are coming to the end. I have some conclusion here. And first I need to give a word of caution about the Zhuozhuan. Because the Zhuozhuan is well known for its moralizing rhetoric, for its depiction of a causal universe of moral retribution, right? So good people get good things, bad people get bad things. So I think some of you may be thinking right now that my analysis of the e-divination practice in the Zhuozhuan has more to say about the Zhuozhuan itself than it does about I Ching divination practice. And that might very well be the case. I just want to tell you why that doesn't bother me. So the I practice recreated, rewritten, or reimagined in the Zhuozhuan is as valid as a representation of the uses of the I Ching as any other. And more than that, it's part of the richness of the I Ching divination, not divination, the usages, the different usages of the I Ching in the tradition, from a mantic tool to learn about the future, to a rhetorical and political tool to influence human behavior and to exercise power. In his review of Li Wai's The Readability of the Past, this work about the Zhuozhuan, my former Princeton advisor, Willard Peterson, said, and I'm kind of paraphrasing him here, he said that the admonitory function of the information set forth in the Zhuozhuan is not related to the truth in knowing about the past, but is related to how to use a narrative that involves certain interpretations of the past in order to say something about the future. So he's saying that it is not about saying the truth about what happened in the past. It's using a narrative about the past to say something about the future, whatever you want to say. So he concludes, if this is true, then the Zhuozhuan doesn't account as historiography. So I believe that the same logic applies to the use of mantic methods by the diviners represented in the Zhuozhuan. So for these diviners, it's not about getting prophetic results. It's about what to do with those results, whatever they are, not only to say something about the future, but to affect the future, to have an impact, to modify the state of affairs in a particular direction. And if this is true, then the practice of e-divination that we are witnessing here doesn't account as mantic practice. It is a political action. Now, conforming becomes a political action only when it is performed by the ruler. Think about the monthly ordinances. They present what we call a model of ecologic or an ecologic naturalistic view of politics in which the ruler is inherent to the natural order because it's only the ruler who can help maintain the cosmic order, right? So in this case, conforming becomes part of a larger rhetorical project of political legitimacy. But when the ordinary person conforms to the calendar, to divination, the field, the sphere of influence is very narrow and limited. It's going to affect only himself and the people more directly connected to him. So there is no political action there, only for the ruler. But adapting can become a political tool in the hands of anyone. We have seen a marketplace diviner who can influence the people's behavior toward a moral behavior, benefiting society overall. And we have seen a court diviner who can heighten the morale of a person who is about to go to war. There are also examples of ministers and persuaders who can prevent the ruler from going to war at all. So this is political actions, and by political action I mean a take of control, an intervention in the state of affairs to make our influence felt at a larger scale, to the extent of being able to change a nation's fate. In this way, adaptation is advocated in many early texts as a more powerful strategy for action than the mantic conforming, because it allows the agent, actually any agent, to take full control and full responsibility, to not rely on anything but himself, his own abilities to read a situation and take advantage of whatever is given to fulfill his goals. Adaptation was seen in early China as the single most efficacious strategy for action, above the use of force, conforming to the cosmos, and prescriptive and ritual actions. diviners, persuaders, ministers, rulers, military commanders, philosophers, and even absolutely ordinary people like butchers, fishers, and swimmers made use of adaptation to deal with uncertainty, to take control of the future, and to affect the future overall. All right, that's it for today. These are my references here.